Thank you, and thank you to the band and to the PA and projector, Ruth on the projector, for helping us make things happen this morning. Now, as Elaine said, we are starting the first of three Sundays where we're looking at carols, well-known carols, one of which we have just sung. And this was the brainchild of Andrew Harvey. I don't think he's around here today. But I've got this one in the bleak midwinter, probably reflecting, in a sense, the weather outside. And today's carol reflects on the coming of the Christ child in the midst of this bleak midwinter, as if the times were dark and wearisome. It was written by a Victorian poet, Christina Rossetti, who also wrote a number of other well-known hymns and carols. And like the wise men, the writer responds to Emmanuel, responds to God with us by desiring to give Jesus her heart. It seems to me that the carol writer is saying that we may not regard ourselves as wise, but the call to give him our hearts is open to everyone. And it's the same call to us today as we approach another Christmas. Are we prepared to give him our hearts? Now, is this forward? Yeah. Andrew, helpfully, he subtitled the carol with this question: what does it look like when you give yourself wholly to God, when you say yes to God's rule in your life? It's saying yes to the kingdom of heaven, where God's will is done. We reflected earlier in the first service about the Lord's Prayer, and we do say, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." And Jesus had much to say about God's kingdom, and most of it was in parables. Is it to the right? Yeah. And I've selected these two kind of many yet very profound parables, and I think it's worth us just quoting them. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again. And then, in his joy, he went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. Very short, yet very profound stories that Jesus sort of encapsulates. Very dense in one sense, but very beautiful in the way that he talks of the kingdom of heaven as something that is precious, it's something that is hidden, and it's then found, and then it's desired above everything else. There is an effort, there is a searching, there's a finding, and there's a responding. And there's also great joy in the discovery, despite the treasure costing everything that they had. The Christmas story of the wise men also reflects this searching, this finding, this discovering, as they found and as they followed the star to Bethlehem. And when they arrived there, they laid their precious gifts at Jesus' feet and worshipped. Finding and discovering treasure is a blessing. And Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So I pose this statement to you: giving him our hearts opens the blessings of God's kingdom. As we celebrate and as we reenact Jesus' coming over the next weeks, it's worth looking at some of the blessings of giving him our hearts entails. On the one hand, it sounds burdensome. It sounds like a duty or something heavy, something that we surrender. And yet, as we look at the scriptures and as we look at how Jesus describes the kingdom or God's rule in our lives, it is a blessing. We've only one life, and yet, if we look at our lives, we see our brokenness, and we also deceive ourselves. Giving him our hearts opens up to us a blessing in our life. It might be multifaceted. We can look at it in many different ways. But I'm just going to look at five blessings that we can have this Christmas season. First one is our hearts are blessed with real peace. Our hearts are restless until we find our peace, our home in Him. We live in a restless age. We don't take the time simply to be and to ponder. A few years ago, I watched a BBC series, maybe some of you also did, Meditations from a Monastery. And three abbeys here in the UK were featured, and the lives of the monks were observed. Now, it was a very interesting program because there was virtually no sound, no comment, three one-hour programs. In complete silence, all they did was observe the lives of these monks as they swept the floors, as they prepared the food, and did other, what you might think, were very mundane tasks, carving wood, etc. The thing that really struck me was they gave a real dignity to the ordinary things in life and a real sense of timelessness and unhurriedness to their day. And it was something that I thought, gosh, we live in a world where everything is rush and everything is hurry. Yet these guys seem to not even live on the same planet as us. Now, I'm sure we're not all called to be monks, but surely there are times in our lives when we need to step aside and rid ourselves of the corrosion of constant interaction with others and the world. We don't need to say it because we're all very, very conscious of it, the effect of social media, the effect of constant emails, constantly being in touch with people, and as Dick mentioned earlier, being in touch with people but actually not communicating and actually not having any real interaction often. And the search for peace is a universal need. It's demonstrated, I think, often in our modern world and the popularity of things like mindfulness and of being in the moment. A sign and symptom of the restlessness that so many of us feel with the pace, the noise, and the frenetic nature of modern life. Of course, our times are not peculiar to high stress. I guess if you lived in Scotland a few hundred years ago, getting hung for sheep stealing would be a pretty stressful experience. William Wordsworth, writing 216 years ago, talks about stress in this way: "For a multitude of causes unknown to former times are now acting with a combined force to blunt the discriminating powers of the mind and unfitting it for all ordinary exertion, to reduce it to a state of almost savage torpor. The most effective of these causes are the great national events which are daily taking place." As I read that a few days ago, I kept thinking about Brexit. "And the increasing accumulation of men in cities where the uniformity of their occupations produces a craving for extraordinary incident, which the rapid communication of intelligence hourly gratifies." You might think he was speaking in the social media age, but that was 216 years ago, where life would, to most of us, seem extremely quiet and not much happening. And that was such a long time ago, and yet we have moved on a lot from there. We also often equate peace with a sense of control. We want to finish everything. If you're my personality, you want to finish everything on your to-do list, and before you finish that one, you've started another list. Peace can also be associated with our security and our safety. Or it can be even a sense of progress or achievement, or maybe even status in the eyes of other people. And all these things, the drive to better ourselves, whether it be by education or hard work or using our talents and abilities, never in themselves give us peace. These actions might be deemed worthy, but it's often a lack of contentment that drives us. They may give us a feeling of well-being, but will not meet our need of real peace. Where is real peace to be found? Here's the psalmist, where really real peace is to be found in the presence of God. He says, "How lovely is your dwelling place. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord." And it's something almost even physical. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. And then he reflects upon the sparrow, that even nature and even something as small and as insignificant as the sparrow can find a home in God's house. And he concludes that passage with saying, "Blessed are all those who dwell in your house. They're always praising you." So the place where God dwells is lovely and it is peaceful. This is a treasure to yearn for, a treasure to long for, to be in God's presence. Blessing number two, our hearts will be blessed with the call to be a disciple. As Christians, we are called to be followers, to be disciple, and the disciple is an apprentice. It embodies the idea of a Jewish father training his child in the family trade, much like perhaps that Jesus learned the trade of carpentry from his father. But we're all apprenticed to Jesus. It is personal. It's like a son or a daughter growing up and learning the family business. Remember, as a wee boy, my dad taught me how to see fish, and he had started off his life as a working life as a fisherman. So I used to love going fishing with him. And he would show me all the spots to fish where he had learned from his own father before him. And there was something lovely and something wonderful about that. My maternal grandfather, he had been a gamekeeper. And in his 70s, he taught me fly fishing on the long summer holidays. There was nothing more exciting for a small boy than to go on the river at 1 a.m. in the morning and fish for sea trout and salmon. Actually, the really exciting thing was, because as a gamekeeper, he was also looking out for poachers. So as a 9 and 10-year-old in the middle of the night, looking out for poachers was an exciting experience. I loved and I respected them for what they gave me in terms of learning how to fish. Really, what I'm trying to convey is that discipleship, learning from Jesus, is not a burden. We can learn from Jesus and we can learn from those more experienced in the Christian life. It is an exciting and it's a joyful process. It's an ongoing learning experience. I think those who teach the Sunday school, they are discipling young people, children, for the future. Now, we won't be exactly like Jesus. We won't become exactly like him. We don't live in first century Palestine, for one thing. And our circumstances and our life and our times are unique to ourselves. Our personalities are our own and no one else's. We're not called to be clones. I often think of that film, The Matrix, where you see Agent Smith replicated hundreds of times. We're not called to be Agent Smiths. We're called to be unique images of what God can do in and with our lives. It's another way of looking at it, asking this question: how to live your life as he would live your life if he was you. There was, I think a few years ago, people don't seem to do it quite so much nowadays, but wear rubber bands saying, what would Jesus do? And that is one example of perhaps questioning how we live and how we behave, having a practical reminder like a band. But at the heart of discipleship is a love for Jesus. It's not service, it's not a burden, it's love. And this is the third blessing that I've listed. We're blessed when we do what Jesus says. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gives these challenging words where he says, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house upon the rock. And then we have that vivid description of the storm coming down and the contrast between the wise man building on the rock and the foolish man who did not obey Jesus' words, his house collapsing. The Sermon on the Mount is a call to action. It's a call to action in our prayer and our giving, in self-denial. It's also a call to our thought life in regard to lust or to anger and our attitudes and so on. Belief is always shown by our actions. You'll always do what you believe. And that's the way that God has made us. In our everyday lives, we know that to be true. If I break my leg and I go to the A&E, it's because I believe that they can do something for me. I can get help there. If a toddler trips and falls, she will turn to her mother because she believes that she'll find comfort there. Many of us like to exercise because we believe it's good for us. Sadly, some people misplace their belief in our society and many turn to various forms of addiction. Despite the evidence to the contrary, they believe it's doing something for them. We might ask, how is it that we say we believe the Bible is the word of God and yet don't spend the time reading, thinking, and praying over it? Intellectually, we might say it's true, but in our hearts, it can be another matter. Jesus expects us to put into practice what he tells us. We're not here talking about earning our salvation. The grace of God is a gift, but grace is not opposed to effort. We're to work out our own salvation. Another question, is the one thing you believe about Jesus that you can act on? A few weeks ago, Fraser Ellis got baptized. He did that publicly. And for him, that was a practical step to show his trust in Jesus. He acted on it and shared it with his friends and the wider church. Paul tells us in Romans that we should offer ourselves as a living sacrifice, offering our bodies to him as a living sacrifice. This might seem a huge thing to do that, but Jesus will take whatever small step we take in terms of who we are and use it for his glory. However small it might be, it's building upon a rock. You know that this is a secure foundation. Jesus is saying that when you put it into practice, what he says, you will have an unshakable confidence in the safety and security of your life. And that leads me on to the fourth blessing. Our hearts are blessed because we discover our life is fundamentally good. Do you believe that your life is good? I'm not talking about whether you or I live a good life. Many people believe they live good lives and may be mistaken. I'm not talking about our circumstances or the things that happen to you or to those you love. Remember, both the wise man and the foolish man had the storms of life thrown at them. The rains came down and the floods came up in both cases. We all have trials in life. But this question, do we believe that our life is good? This question literally goes to the heart of our relationship with God. Do you believe in the fundamental goodness of this life that God has given you, the only life that you have? It involves accepting the circumstances of your birth, your upbringing, your opportunities. For example, we're told to honor our father and mother. That can be hard for some people. The family that you have, you didn't choose to belong to. And you can keep saying, if only this was different, if only that was different, if only I had a different background, if only I was brought up in a different place, if only I went to a different school, so on and so forth. And I think as you get older, we can tend to grumble even more. That seems to be my experience. Sometimes children have much to teach us and are much more accepting of their lives and circumstances. The other night, I watched Louis Theroux's new series, one of his series, An Altered States, and it was on open abortion in the United States. And I'd never heard of this thing, but apparently you can be adopted, and then later on in life, your adopted mother and then your other birth mother can meet up and you can all be one big happy family. You think, my goodness, what a mess. But this story, this program said that one boy who had been given up by his mother at birth to another family, and at 10 years old, he was given the opportunity to meet his birth mother. The mothers, of course, were fraught. They didn't know what was going to happen, and as they went to the airport, but this boy just went up and hugged his birth mother, and then just in the story, you could just see how the acceptance of this boy, of his circumstances, was leading all the adults in the story to just be filled with love and acceptance of the whole situation. Doubting God's good purposes for us goes right back to the fall. There the serpent sowed the lie that lodged in the minds of Adam and Eve. We're to celebrate the life he's given us. David had a colorful life, to say the least. He had many ups and downs. But here's what he says. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. Apart from you, I have no good thing. There was nothing else in his life or his experience that he regarded as fundamentally good. Lord, you alone are my portion and my cup. You make my lot secure. And then the boundary lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. Think also of another Old Testament character, Joseph. He suffered terrible injustice, sold as a slave by his own brothers, unfairly thrown into jail for acting with integrity with Potiphar's wife. Then he was forgotten by the Pharaoh's chief cupbearer when he helped secure his release. Finally, at the end, Joseph was promoted to a high position, but you might think he would be a man filled with bitterness when he did come to meet his brothers who had started it all. But then he said, no, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done. He saw God's hand in his life, and he saw that God's intentions were good. We've only one life to live. Our life is totally unique, and he also gives us great dignity. I think of Psalm 139, which many of you would know, just that wonderful picture of how God searches us and knows us, has a plan and has many thoughts for us. And the marvel is that God makes us responsible for this life. We are to own it. We can't abdicate this responsibility to anyone or anything else. I like very much what Dallas Willard says here. Your life is not something from which you can stand aside and consider what it would have been like had you had a different one. There is no you apart from your actual life. You're not separate from your life. In that life, you must find the goodness of God. Otherwise, you will not believe that he's done well by you, and you will not truly be at peace with him. If we believe our lives are fundamentally good, we will, as Willard says, learn to live with deep contentment, joy, and confidence in our everyday experience. And that leads me to the final blessing, which I think we've got time for. Our hearts are blessed with a bargain. We started by reflecting on Jesus' two parables of what the kingdom of heaven is like, and return to it now. Notice that in the parable that the man in his joy went and sold everything that he had. There's no burden here. There's no sense of sacrifice, as if the cost was needed to be thought through carefully. He was gripped by the treasure. He knew the treasure was worth infinitely more than what he had, and yet he could have it. He knew he was getting a bargain. God's grace is the greatest bargain there is. I was trying to think through what that would be in Jesus' parable would kind of sound like in our time. I suppose it's a wee bit like going out house hunting and finding an empty house that's worth 200,000. And then as you're going around this house, you discover under the floorboards 10 million pounds of gold stashed away. I would imagine you would do everything in your power to get that 200,000 pounds and get that house. And that's what it is with the treasure that God offers us. It's a treasure infinitely more than we even can comprehend, and yet it is a treasure that will cost us everything that we have. But in that exchange, there is great joy, there is great peace, and there is great fulfillment. The wise men who also went to Jesus, they were also filled with joy when they saw that star over the manger in Bethlehem. They went on their way filled with joy after they had given what they had. This Christmas, once again, we have the opportunity to give ourselves to him and find Jesus, the treasure, the pearl of great price. Thank you.